difference between the story of...
This is the 13th lecture in the series on the book of Genesis. With this particular lecture, we begin the age of the patriarchs with Lech Lecha. Thursday night, March 9th, 1961. To the Near East. We start today the era of the patriarchs of the Avos with Lech Lecha on page 17. Of course, this is actually a second Bereishis, if you will. Just like the very beginning of Bereishis is the beginning of the physical universe, we begin now the beginning of the history of the Jewish people. In other words, Bereishis as a book, as a chumash, contains three starts, three phases. The beginning of a natural universe, the beginning of the human race, and the beginning of the Jewish people. This is the last of the three great beginnings, the beginning of the Jewish people. The principle to remember in all of the Chumash regarding Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov is the statement of Chazal that Ma'aseh Avos Siman Levonim, that the deeds of the patriarchs or of the fathers are a sign or a pattern for their children or descendants. In other words, whether history repeats itself is another problem. But here it certainly does, in the sense that the entire biography of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov were what we call paradigmatic. They set the pattern for a repetition later on in history with their children. And as we go on, you'll see this pattern repeated very clearly. Now, what is the significance of this? What is this? Why is this important? Why should it be so? One, it's in the nature of the prophecy to Abraham, that God told Abraham that Ger Yezaracha and so on and so forth, they'll come wandering to this country too. There seems to be a message to Abraham that expresses itself not only in words but in deeds. The Ramban points out the true significance when he says that Nevuah, prophecy, expresses itself not only in a message of words and not only in symbols of pictures, but the message and the symbol are also expressed in deeds. And he brings several examples from Yechezkel, from Yirmiyahu, from Yeshayahu, where God not only tells them to say something, but he tells them to do something. But look at the example of Hosea, who married this woman, who was a prostitute. Or the story of Yechezkel, whose wife dies, and it's a symbol for Klal Yisrael, when he's told not to mourn for her for certain reasons. Peicha Chavosha Lecha, if you remember, and so on and so forth. Or Yeshayahu, in the temple, he himself has to act out part of the prophecy. It's not enough to speak it. At certain points, speech fails, and the act becomes a symbol of the future, the warning, and the promise. Similarly, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov are a pre-recapitulation of the entire history that is to follow. The sense of it is basically to show that number one, that this is a prophecy, simply, that this is part of after the era of the Avos, the Jews are aware of what's going to happen, that they will not be destroyed, that they're going to go through difficult times, but they're going to survive, and this will be the pattern, including the Geula. Number two, the significance is to show the imminence of God in history. When you have a repetition of the same pattern, then it no longer is a matter of chance. It no longer is a matter of blind forces. Look, how could it be blind forces if the thing repeated itself? There's evidence of an intelligence working in history, which proof would be lacking if the stories were totally different. I mean, you take a deck of cards, you know what happens. If you find a deck of cards, you find it ace, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten, jack, queen, king, all four colors in a row, then you assume that human hands touched this thing at one time. Whereas if you find them all mixed up, then you don't assume that they were organized by any individual human being with a mind of his own. The fact that you see a repetitiveness in the history of the children, reflecting the life of the forefathers, indicates that there is this kind of intellectual or this intelligent design, which means the Etzba Elokim, the presence of God in history. But according to Ramban, it primarily is a form of nevuah. Nevuah by God to the Jewish people through the life of the others. Now what is the background of Avraham Avinu? The background of the whole era of the Avos. You have to go back, of course, to the part we discussed last term. And that is that two experiments were made by God, not experiments in which he wanted to discover something, but experiments in which he gave us the opportunity to prove ourselves. Both words, experiment and the trial for us, are one word in Hebrew, nisayon. God gave mankind two chances to achieve success in its mission in a universal manner. Look, God created Adam, and did he choose any one family, any one people? No. Everyone was given an equal chance, equal access to God, equal access to revelation, equal opportunity to prove themselves ethically, ethically competent, ethically successful. But nothing happened. Nothing happened to prove that the confidence of God was well placed. What happened the first time God gave him a chance? The Dor HaMabul, wasn't it? The Dor HaMabul. And the second time God tried again, yes? So God destroyed the entire world except for one family, which means in essence, what was Noah? Noah was starting with Adam all over again. He was another example of how you start from scratch. And did God distinguish between Shem, Ham, and Yafis? No. They were all given equal opportunities. All of mankind, again, is equal before God. No one is singled out above all the others. What happens? The Dor HaHafluga. The Tower of Babel.
Weren't there different blessings before the tower?
Not to any individuals. Mankind. Yes, but the curse later was given after an act was done. But in the beginning, blessings were given, but no one was singled out for a spiritual mission. In other words, again, what is the element here? Twice man is given the chance to achieve spiritual eminence through universalism. There's a complete universalism, a complete lack of selection. A lack of election, to be more exact. No one is elected to be special. In both cases, there is failure. Once it's the Dor HaHafluga, once it's the Dor HaMabul, once it's the Tower of Babel, once the Flood. At this point, we find that something different happens. God realizes, b'shagam hu basar, that since man is not equipped for this, not only is man himself born with a Yetzer Hara, with a destructive tendency, but also, in addition, society as such has a corrupting tendency. And if you allow all people to live in society without discrimination, spiritually, then no one is going to take the reins, and mankind will never succeed. Mankind must fail. So what does God do with this third attempt? This is actually the third beginning. There's Adam, there's Noah, and now Avraham. That's why in Perek you have Asara Doros mi Adam v'ad Noach, Asara Doros mi Noach v'ad Avraham. The in-betweens are unimportant. Adam represents the first universalist experiment which failed. Noach represents the second which failed. Now comes Avraham, in which universalism is discarded as what? Altogether? Would you say that with Avraham universalism is discarded? What happens instead? What is the difference between Avraham and Noah? I mean, after all is said and done. All right, Avraham was a greater tzaddik, a lesser tzaddik. We're not going to measure the length of his tzitzis. But what was the important point? Well, what does Judaism mean? There was no Judaism in the world then. Yes, it's true. That's a measure of the difference of their personalities. Quite true. That's related to what Mrs. Tenenbaum said. But let's go away from Noach and Avraham as individuals. How about God's attitude? How did God differ at this point of history? What new tactic did he take with mankind that he did not take before? Well, no, when Noah was born, I mean, after the flood, God also promised never to destroy. So it was nothing new. Let's start understanding it again. With Adam, with Noah, God gave them commandments, God gave them a way of life to follow, and he did not distinguish or discriminate between their descendants. Everyone is given an equal chance. That's what I mean by universalism. No one nation is singled out above others. What happens with Abraham? He's singled out. Look at Lech Lecha. Vayomer Adonai al Avram Lech Lecha Me'atzach 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 Me'atzach. Then Pasuk 2 is Ve'eschol L'goy Godol Va'avarechacha Va'agadlo Shmecha Ve'heyei Bracha. God singles out Abraham to be a special group. And later on you have that his children will receive the blessing. So that no longer do we have the whole world equally before God in this sense. What then does it mean? What has happened now?
Well,
yes?
Well, one might say that if God had not promised not to destroy the world, then it would seem that he would have been provoked in the same thing here. He would have saved Abraham, he would have put him into an ark, he would have had the same thing over and over.
Well, no, God had promised after Noah never to destroy the world.
Well, that's exactly the reason, it seems, that Abraham here was singled out. Otherwise,
well, that's a good point. That's a good point, but then you see that God abandons the tactic of allowing mankind to proceed on its own. But what I'm pointing out, you have the idea of a chosen people here enters the picture. Abraham is chosen. His descendants are chosen. What's that? Why not? With Noah,
No,
there's a difference. With Noah, he is saved and everyone else no longer, they disappear. It's comparing existence to non-existence. It's not comparing chosen to unchosen. There's quite a difference.
Well, this seems to be the only alternative. In other words, it would seem to be the same set of circumstances, except that God is limited in that, and therefore he simply has to do this.
Well, all right, I'll prove that you're wrong. You say, in other words, what happens here is that God saves Abraham and condemns the rest of the world. That's just what I mean. In other words, instead of having universalism, you have an absolute nationalism.
He ignores them.
You have an absolute nationalism. That would be the Havami. That's what you would want to think. Well, that's what you do think. But I'll show you that you're wrong. And here you have an insight into the whole concept of the doctrine of election, which means the chosen people idea. And that is, what is the last part of verse 3? And thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. In other words, God gives Avraham a bracha so that through him the rest of mankind will have bracha. Yeah, but this is just what it does mean. Because this is what happens later on when the second Bechira, the second time that God affirms the chosenness of Israel, and he says, Ki li kol ha'aretz, and Sfarno very wisely interprets it. Because all the world is mine, and I want someone to bring the message of God to all the world. And the idea of making Israel a mamleches kohanim, a kohen can serve if there is no people behind him. Israel serves as a kohen for the world, which means not that he neglects the world. On the contrary, the chosenness of Israel is to effect somehow a change to the better for the rest of the world. Just what God tells Avraham here. The purpose of my selecting you is not that I'm going to leave the rest of the world in limbo and to ignore them in some kind of spiritual netherland, but rather that I'm going to use you as the means to give them a bracha. So what happens now? It doesn't mean that God abandons universalism. What does it mean then? It means that God uses nationalism, I'm using the word advisedly, as a means towards a universalistic goal. So the goal remains that all mankind should find a bracha. V'hoya Adonai l'melech al kol ha'aretz. B'yom hu Hashem echad shmo echad cannot come about unless all the world is one. But how is it achieved? Not through all the people together at one time, but rather by singling out one people to be a teacher to the other to the rest of the world. Whether or not the others want to be students is another question. But they were designated as such. They may be bad students, but they were designated. You know what Chazal say, that after Matan Torah, V'yelchu Mishalach, we have V'yelchu Shloshes Yomim B'li Mayim. They went 3 days without water, and Chazal say they went 3 days without Torah, because Torah means water, or water means Torah. So Chazal say, Ketinuk HaBoreich MiBeis HaSefer. They left for 3 days, they ran away from Har Sinai like a child running away from school. Well, if we're the teacher, the priest teachers of the world, the rest of the world has shown an inclination for playing hooky on the universalistic or a cosmic scale. But that doesn't matter. The point is that Avraham becomes the bearer of bracha for the rest of the world. And the Zera Avraham become the Mamleches Kohanim to the rest of the world, just as Avraham was in his day. Now, the story of Avraham, where he comes from, for many years was believed to be a myth. If you would have talked to any Bible critics until 10, 15, 20 years ago, the whole story of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov was a beautiful poem. In some cases, it wasn't even beautiful. It was a myth, you know, that the writers of the Bible dreamt up in order to establish a yichus for themselves. But everything that was told about these people was mythological. Perhaps there was a core of truth about some desert nomad who founded a tribe, and he was called Ibrahim or something of the sort. You know, they took the whole chumash and they just pushed it aside. The last 15 years, however, I've seen a great deal of archaeological excavations, perhaps 20, 25 years. And what we have found in the last 20, 25 years is that almost every single word of the Torah that can be verified has been verified. An amazing amount of details have been uncovered, or literally unearthed, which bear out the fact that Avram was not simply the chieftain of some small nomadic tribe, but that it came from the Ur of the Chaldees, Ur HaKasdim, which was a highly developed society, basically a city in a valley, with an economy of its own, with marketplaces well developed, with temples highly developed, and that to this place, from this place, there were tribes of Bedouins that traveled back and forth. And the wanderings, there were wanderings, of course, over the Near East, even though there were cities. But the wanderings were occurred earlier, if you remember from the Chumash. There still were some wanderings. The wanderings were mainly for military reasons, economic reasons, or diplomatic reasons. In the case of Avraham, you have what reason? A religious reason.
There's reference to him in archaeological discoveries.
No, there's reference to the whole background of Avraham, such that the stories could not have been made up by the imagination of some writer who lived after the time of Ezra. It was impossible. Because conditions had changed so radically that they could not reconstruct it if they did not have an accurate record, an authentic record.
The stuff is that the dating of this book might have been early. It doesn't show that they existed.
Oh, well, look, yes, but if the dating is accurate, if the background is accurate, there's no reason to doubt the story. I tell you why. Because if the story were concocted, the background would have had to be concocted too.
No.
Besides, I'll tell you something else. Even the Agadas of Chazal have been shown to be very accurate. You know, in Tehillim, there is one psalm that is written, Maskil le'Eson ha'ezrachi. A song for Eson ha'ezrachi. Who is Eson ha'ezrachi? Doesn't know. The Talmud says that Eson ha'ezrachi is an old Agada, that Eson, the strong one, refers to Abraham. In many places the Talmud says that, and it says specifically that this psalm was written by Abraham. Now, no one can uncover a document, an autograph, which should have the whole Tehillim, the whole psalm, and at the bottom it should be signed Avraham with a notary public attached to it, that you'll never find. But you do find something interesting, that the specific literary composition of this psalm, a very similar thing, almost identical in style, in flavor, in idiom, has been found in a language which is known only for 50 years now. It had not been known, Ugaritic. And the Ugarites, the Ugaritic language, was used in the times of Avraham Avinu. So that when Chazal picked out this psalm above all others, as going back to Avraham, pointing out that he was Eson HaEzrachi, they knew exactly what they were talking about. So even the oral tradition has in many ways been confirmed.
Chazal certainly knew it, and in the time of Ezra, which is much earlier, people could have known it. People could have discerned it.
No. Chazal did not reconstruct the situation.
No,
they identified. Which means, but they also pointed out to Avraham as such. Which certainly was in his day. The story of Lot and Avraham, the advanced nature of society at that time, as we're told, the kings of Sodom, all these, of course, again, you have the record of Avraham as such. It would be very unusual to have that. Most unusual. If you found it, there would be suspicions of someone having planted it. Because one or two individuals to find out of a whole history is difficult. But all the pieces of information are accurate. So that if the so-called higher Bible critics or even lower Bible critics of 60, 70, 80 years ago, or 70 years ago, 50 years ago, had known the information we have today, they never would have said that it's a myth. As a matter of fact, looking at it from our point of view, their reconstructions, the critics' reconstructions, are more mythological than anything else. And if you want to know what pshat is, you have to learn the Chumash. Now, if you'll notice, in the beginning of Lech Lecha, the Torah gives us very few details about the background of Avraham. Very few. You almost don't know anything about him. Where do you begin? You begin at the top of the page, don't you? Yes. At the end of Noah, the top page 17. Terach lived 70 years, and he had Avraham, Nachor, and Haran. And then Terach had Avraham, Nachor, and Haran. Haran had Lot. And Haran died whilst his father was alive. We'll learn, I'll tell you later about the story of why he died and how he died. In his birthplace, which was Ur of the Chaldees, or Ur of Kasdim. And Avraham and Nachor got married, a simple story. Sarah didn't have a child. Terach went with his son and his grandson, Avraham and Lot, and his daughter-in-law. They went out to go to Canaan, they reached Haran, there Terach died, period. We still don't know a thing about Abraham. It's very little. And suddenly, the next Shabbos you begin, and suddenly Avraham has a full-flown revelation of God and the commandment that he's going. He started on a life's career, a life's mission. What happened when he was younger? Haran is not in Canaan. It's on the way to Canaan. It's on the way to Canaan. So that you're faced with very few details. Evidently the Torah did not want to tell us more, or wasn't interested in telling us more than this. Sufficient material to tell you, number one, how it came about that an individual acknowledged God and was able to lead up to the point where he formed a covenant with God and formed a religious society, which is the importance of Avraham. Number two, how Avraham, this individual, was able to receive the promise, the two promises that God gave him. Number one, relating to descendants, that he will have descendants who will have certain experiences happening to them. Number two, they will have a country of their own, there will be a nation of their own. And number three, to show us that the life of Avraham is a prefiguration of the life of his children. But I said before, Maase Avos Simola Banim, which means that what for Abraham is biography, for Israel is history, because of the divine influence in history. Specifically, I will go along later on to show you the exact details. Specifically, you'll find it in the fact that Avraham conquers certain territory as a result of the war. Why the whole story of the war? Later on, we'll study the war of the four kings and the five kings and the going around the country. Because his presence in Canaan, where he walks and where he goes, actually predetermines the later boundaries of Israel when Yehoshua conquers the land.
I understand that Yehoshua took the same path that Avraham
did, yes.
Almost city by city.
Which is a remarkable example of Maase Avos Simola Banim. And you'll see later on the story of Chaye Sarah. Of when Sarah dies, he wants to buy the place from Ephron of Hiti. Why did he want to pay for it so much? All right, there's an Oriental lavishness, you know, a great deal of talking, little meaning, which incidentally today is present in the Orient too. Mr. Naus will bear me out about the rest of the Orient. I don't know how Japan is. In India, they talk so much you can go mad. They just talk and talk and talk. you speak for half an hour, which follows a one-hour introduction and a two-hour postscript by somebody else, and it means meaningless. Here too, there's elaborate negotiations and bowing and no, you take it, don't take it, and they don't mean it meanwhile. Granted, But Avram is a man of few words. He certainly doesn't show this inclination to talk a lot. When the angels come to visit him, he says, "Have a piece of bread," and he brings them a whole banquet. But why is he so insistent upon paying for that piece of territory? He wants a chazakah. He may not have known it, but the Hashgacha knew it. He has to have a place. He has to purchase it as well as win it. He has a place. His dead are buried there. And if his dead are buried there, then he is there too. That's why Jews throughout history wanted to bury their dead in Eretz Yisrael. If you bury your dead in the country where you are, then that's your land. If you bury your dead elsewhere, then that's your land. That's why Yaakov and Yosef wanted to be buried in Eretz Yisrael, not in Mitzrayim. And that's why for Yosef it was such a remarkable thing. Sheni LaMelech, he was the prime minister of the day, and in this act of telling his brothers to bury him in Mitzrayim, it was a very brazen thing. It means that he too wasn't an Egypt firster. So while the Torah itself does not give us very many details, only the meagerest details, there are a series of very interesting agadas that the Torah Sheba'al Peh tells us. See, the Torah Sheba'al gave us very few details, probably because it was more interested in showing us Avraham Avinu as a father of the Jewish people than as a son of Terach. He had more yichas in the first role than in the second role. The son of Terach was no great yichas. In fact, that's when the Haggadah we start with the Gnai, Maschil Begnus. We begin with the low element. What is the low element? The fact that we started from Terach. So the Torah is more interested in telling us about Avraham's later achievements. But the Agoda tells us certain very interesting stories, and you probably have heard them, but I ought to repeat them because there's a certain importance to them. The first one, who was the great king of those days? The emperor. Nimrod. You know the story of Nimrod. His astrologers had foretold him that a young child would be born who would someday cause a revolution in the world which would topple his kingdom, his beliefs, and everything else. And he would no longer be a god. His astrologers told him that the child would be born in such and such a day of such and such a year, and he ordered that all pregnant mothers be taken into prison, and those who give birth in those days to a baby boy, the children are to be killed. Those who give birth to girls are supposed to be honored. The mother of Abraham was taken into custody. Well, that is, they wanted to take her into custody, but she escaped and was hiding out in a cave. On the day that Abraham was born, 70,000 boys were killed. Infants were killed. Abraham was abandoned in the cave. His mother ran away. And there he grew up under the guidance of an angel. And the Agada is very, very imaginative. He sucked his thumb. When a miracle happened, the milk sprouted from his thumb. And that's how he received nourishment and grew up by himself in the cave. Interesting again, because it shows you that according to the Agada, and when you read Agada, when you study Agada, you never take the details themselves as significant, but you take the insight that they point to as significant. Agada is not meant to be taken as literally so. Indicating, of course, that Avraham led what kind of childhood? A sort of solitary childhood. Very solitary life. He was a thinking sort, contemplative. He wasn't the socially gregarious type who was a backslapper. He was more or less a thinking person who was by himself, suffered solitude. Then the Agada continues, he went out of the cave. There are two Agadas. One says that Avram was about 8 years old, very young, when he came to the understanding of God. The other one says 43 or 48, that Avram has a later year. The other Agada has less rationalistic, has an earlier age. Whatever it is, he came to understand God. This is the greatness of Avram in our tradition. That Avram came to God before God came to Avram. And how did he come to it? So this first Agada continues, he came and saw the stars, and he says, well, that must be God, stars. The next morning, the sun rose and the stars disappeared. He says, how could they be God? If they're eclipsed, they couldn't be God. In other words, he already understood something that the others did not understand. He understood that what? That in order to be God, you have to be perfection. You have to be the highest. A God who is higher than whom there can be another being is no longer God. So he thought the sun was God. But then the sun set and the moon came out. So, well, the moon must be God. But as he kept on noticing the moon, the moon waxed and waned. He says, well, something that waxes and wanes can't be God. And they came to the conclusion there must be a God that created all of these who was invisible. The second Agada states that... what's that?
It's lucky he wasn't a philosopher.
But he was not?
It's lucky he wasn't.
Well, he was, in a sense, in a very primitive way. He begins this way. In other words, what is he using in order to determine whether there's a God or not? Reason. Simple reason. The second Agada states that Avram was went into his father's business. His father was an idol salesman. In fact, this is a known Agada. In many places you refer to the fact that Terach complained to Nimrod that Avram was an iconoclast. What is an iconoclast? Someone who blasts the icons. He breaks the idols. And Avram would be in charge of selling for his father. His father was in the retail business too. He had a retail outlet. And so he was selling the idols, and the Agada tells us that a man would come to buy an idol, and Avram would say, which one do you want? He would say, this one. He would say, I can't give him to you because he just died. So what are you talking about? How can an idol die? Well, is he alive? No, he's not alive. How can you believe in something that's not living? Or he would say, which idol do you want? He would mention a certain name. He would say, well, he was stolen. Well, give me another one. Well, if he's stolen, how can he protect you against thieves if he can't protect himself against thieves? Things of this sort. He would show the purchasers that they were very stupid. This was a very important function he was fulfilling. He was fulfilling in the religious scheme. For his father's business, it wasn't too good. Some geschäft das nicht geteilt, you see. As a result, his father took him to Nimrod, complained about him. When he came to Nimrod, the city was called Ir Nimrod, the tremendous metropolis for those days. And as he came and saw the city, he was a provincial boy, evidently. He noticed a tremendous city, and he was overwhelmed. And he suddenly had an insight. He had already had abandoned idolatry, obviously, but he still hadn't come to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And he came to the idea, Ha'eshar Labira Below Manhig. Is it possible that this whole city is running orderly without anyone administering it or paying attention to it? Similarly, can there be an entire world running without there being a mind or a being that controls all this? Later on, many, many centuries later, the Greeks gave it a fancy name. They call this the teleological proof of God's existence. The first one is called what? The first one would be more of the ontological proof. You see, if you change the terms, you have the philosophy there. But in an agadic way, in a agadic style, with a beautiful, naive way, you have the seeds of the whole thing. So you have these two agados which tell you about how he did it. Another difference, the first one is gradual versus the stars. In other words, Abraham traveled from one Avodah Zarah to another until he came to the realization of God. His way to the Ribbono Shel Olam was slow, gradual, halting, tortuous. The second one is not that way. The second one is that there were basically two steps. Number one, the abandonment of Avodah Zarah, then a sort of in-between period, then a sudden understanding. Ha'efshar labir below manik, an intuitive insight. There must be a Ribbono Shel Olam. A very fast and sudden one. Also important is this, that according to the second Agada, the minute that Abraham said the Efshel Abira below Manhig, and he came to the understanding that there is a God in the world, so what happened? Gabriel, the angel Gabriel, appeared to Abraham and told him that there is a God, and this God is now contacting him, and this God will speak to him. What does this show? This shows that in order to be truly religious, it's good to begin with an intellectual insight, with a philosophic approach, with reason. Eshel abir below manik, and there'd be a big city without a mayor, without a leader. But you have to have not grace, but revelation. Grace means everything already. You have to have the element of, call it grace if you wish, the element of revelation, of nevuah. God has to come to you too. God must appear to man. Because if you only philosophize, then your conception of God cannot be perfect. And this bears out that Rambam, Yehuda Halevi, and especially Saadia, in their understanding of the fact that no matter how much you emphasize reason, and they emphasize it beyond all proportion, especially Saadia and the Rambam, you still must have the element of God, Vayered Hashem al Har Sinai, of God appearing to man, of God coming down to us, of God favoring us with his presence and with his understanding. But incidentally, this idea of Abraham discovering God by saying, Ha'efshel Abira Below Manhig, Because how can there be a whole city without a leader? How can there be a whole world? This is called, as I said, the teleological reason, or in plain mamaloshim, what is it called? The argument from design. Since you see that nature is so orderly, then there must be a designer. There's a fable, it's not, actually not true, about the man who came to the Rambam in Egypt. He said he wanted to come to the Rambam to debate the existence of God. And as he walked into the Rambam's office, so-called, he noticed that there was a beautiful painting on his desk, on his table, and in the corner, a bottle of ink was spilled over on the side. He looked, he was thought it was remarkably unneat for a man of this man's fame and reputation and office. And as they were talking about the existence of God, the Rambam said, incidentally, how do you like this painting? He said, beautiful. He said, well, you know what happened? The bottle of ink spilled out and it painted itself. The picture just occurred. The ink went along these lines. He said, are you crazy? It's impossible. A bottle of ink spills, it sometimes will form a strange design. But such an intricate and complex painting is impossible. He said, so what are you asking about the world having a God or not? He said, is it possible that this thing formed itself by itself? This is essentially the argument from design, called the teleological argument, which Avraham Avinu, according to the Agada, used in order to achieve his insight into the existence of Eder Bona Shalom. Now, that means that you have reason, revelation, and what is the third source of knowledge about God? That you don't find what you couldn't possibly find with Avraham, but you do find with his son and his grandson.
Condition.
That's it. Avraham, you couldn't find it with, for what reason?
It
he started it. But you notice that with Yitzchak, he refers to Elokei Avraham. Yaakov refers to Elokei Avraham Upachad Yitzchak. They refer to tradition too. That's a third source of religious knowledge. Number one is your mind. Number two is revelation or Torah. Number three is tradition or Torah, both combined. So that tradition is a third source of religious knowledge, which Saadia counts as such too, and you see it in the story of Avraham Avinu.
What did these people here, supposing that flood did exist, what did these people believe on it? What was their conception of it?
The people who lived in the times of Noah?
Yeah.
Or after?
Who lived afterwards in the times of Abraham?
Oh, well, I read you last term some of the Babylonian, the Mesopotamian story. They attributed it to a fight between the gods. I mean, it all started because one god was very upset that he couldn't sleep, the people making too much noise.
But there was no contrary tradition similar to the one we have here.
There was no what?
Was there any contrary tradition? Or at least one similar to the one you have here.
No.
Not at all.
Similar only in the idea of an ark being built and someone being saved.
I mean,
the historical elements are similar. But the spiritual explanation is completely different.
And there was nothing to
nothing.
All.
Nothing like our story. Nothing like our story. Now, let me read to you. To understand Avraham Avinu, you have to understand, I want to read how the Rambam understood the significance of Avraham Avinu. The Rambam, in the very, very first chapter of Hilchos Avodah Zarah, the Laws of Idolatry. Bimei enosh tov b'nei adam toras gedolah v'neveras v'nevaro atzas chachamim chachmei osei hadar. In the days of Enosh, who was what? What to Avraham, the son of Abraham. Or there was another Enosh who was also a grandson. In the days of Enosh, people began to make a great error. And the wisdom of the sages of that generation began to disappear. Enosh himself, you find it, Moshe, where you have the Oz Huchal Likro B'Shem Hashem. That's what it means, Oz Huchal. Look, what is this? How many generations from Adam is he? That's what I'd like to find out. What's that? There's another Enosh later on. There's Adam Enosh Shays.
Yeah.
He's a first generation? Isn't there one later on?
You mean a son of Abraham?
No. There should be a great grandson of Enosh. Or maybe it's a son. That's what I was wondering about. No.
Shays.
So it's a grandson. I was right. It's a grandson. So in the days of Enosh, a mistake happened to occur. Omru, they said, Ho ve'elohim barakochavim elu v'galgalam l'haneges ha'olam. Since God created such tremendous beings called stars and planets in order to lead the world and put them up on high, and he gave them so much kavod that they should be able to perform so much, then it is the will of God that we should glorify whom he has glorified. He has glorified the stars and the sun, therefore we too should glorify the stars and the sun. In the same way that a king wants you to give honor to those whom he has honored. If he gives someone the order of a god, he expects you to honor him as well. When they took this step, they took the next step. They began to build palaces, or temples rather, to the stars, and to offer to them sacrifices, and to sing psalms to them. In order through them to be able to influence or to understand or to influence the creator of the whole world. This, he said, is the beginning and the essence of idolatry. Now mind you, the Rambam understands here that this is the meaning of idolatry. The idol worshiper does not say that there is no other god but this star, or but this whatever it may be that he worships. Who does not fear you, O King of all the nations? Everyone fears God. Even the idol worshiper believes in God. There is no question about that. The problem is, do you go directly to God, or do you bow down to what they call a manifestation of God? Now, when we learn Chumash, what is our understanding of idolatry? That they actually believe that this thing is God. Well, the Rambam is right. And here I saw it myself. You asked me to talk about it. Here I saw it myself. I met one young fellow. He came to my hotel because he's friends with the Bnei Israel, and he wanted to find out about Judaism. This chap was a Brahmin, a young 24-year-old, 25-year-old, short, handsome chap. A Brahmin means Mishamna Misulsa, the Smetana of India. He's the priest, the aristocrat. Intelligent young fellow. He came to ask me about Judaism, and I thought, look, I'm not going to be impolite to him, but I want to be direct to him. I said, do you bow down to any statues? He said, certainly. I said, how can you, an intelligent person, believe that this thing is a god? But you're an intelligent man, I said. You speak a good English. You probably have university training. This is nonsense. He says, well, we don't believe that the lingam or the cow is God itself, so why do you bow down to it? He says, we believe that in the moment that we worship this thing, then God appears through it. Then God wants us to worship it. We believe there's a God above all this. But he has 1,000 or 1,000,000 manifestations. He manifests himself in a cow, in a monkey, in a dog, in a statue. And while we worship it, it's a God. The moment we finish, it's only a statue. You see, this is just what the Rambam says. They never believe that this itself is God. But it becomes God through worship, and it's the will of the one God that we worship him. So as a result, you have a major God with all minor manifestations of him.
It would seem though that the Torah wasn't aware of that. It would seem that the
Why?
Torah is depicted always in a very simple-minded way.
Yes, you're right. For what purpose?
I don't know.
What? No. To point to the ridiculousness of the act.
No, but I mean, you find the meme saying,
that's right. How can you believe that this is a manifestation of God when it's blind?
But they don't believe that. It would seem that
they believe at the moment of prayer that God is imminent in this thing, that this becomes a God. Not that there is no God, mind you. Not that there is no God, but that this becomes a God.
Well, I mean, but then the prophet couldn't come along and say, well, you're ignorant, that's not really so.
Yeah. They never were accused of ignorance. They never were accused of it. That's our interpretation of ignorance. They were accused of other things. They were accused of religious crime, of blasphemy.
Well, you just accused this Brahmin of being ignorant.
No, I accused him because I didn't know. Then he explained it to me, and I found out that he was giving me the Rambam back. I reminded myself of the Rambam. Really, I did. I had read this Rambam. To me, it seemed to be only a medieval, a scholastic rationalization. Until I found it myself. Even the idol worshiper who is more obtuse, who believes in the statue, still believes in a metaphysical principle that's beyond all these various gods. He has chosen this deity to worship throughout his life. He believes that the one manifests himself in these things.
But the Torah doesn't attack that idea.
It does.
It would would seem to imply, if only reading this and not reading the Rambam, reading anything else, it would seem to imply that the people that really believe that the idol is supernatural, the idol has powers.
I can't believe, so I'll tell you why. They brought fruit to the idol. They saw that it wasn't eaten. How could they believe that the idol itself, it's in other words, it's too,
no, I mean, what,
it's too blatant. It's too blatant.
Somewhere where the priest used to go and eat that. I remember reading.
You know, this is the priest used to eat it, let's say. This is an agada. But what do you do? You see, they didn't worship a tree, they worshiped the spirit of the tree. That's why they offered fruit. The tree itself, I saw a sacred tree. All kind of other desires. I feel it much more strongly. And I saw the bowls of fruit they put on the bottom of the tree to serve the spirit of the tree.
They left it there.
If it had been the tree itself, you could have asked, the tree can't eat, how can you serve it? But the spirit of the tree can understand that you're bringing him something.
Yeah, again, but why doesn't it?
But there's a spirit to it. There's a spirit of a tree. This spirit of the tree is a manifestation of the one God. Well, to us, this is kier, this is televa, this is blasphemy.
See,
but this is
about
the Zohar.
I answer that because I remember reading somewhere was criticized because its interpretation of idolatry would seem to imply that it was written in a time when idolatry wasn't very prevalent and therefore misunderstood it.
I doubt it.
And the description in it would seem to verify.
I doubt it. The description of idolatry, the punishment would not have been that severe hadn't it been prevalent at that time. Look, in the times of Yeshayahu and Yirmiyahu, you had Avodah Zarah yet. Until Bayis Rishon, you had Avodah Zarah. The Pesel Micha, the days of Joshua, where a man built statues, one of them he called Yud Kei Vav Kei, the other one he called Elohim, the other one he called Rachav and Hanan, a whole bunch of statues, each one he gave a different name of God.
Archaeology has found the existence of the idols that were very mentioned
in the Torah. Yes.
The trees.
You found the place where the Kadeshos lived.
Yeah, but the thing is, this author mentioned that it would imply that this was written much after the time. Because he didn't understand the Reyeses by Dalai.
No. No, on the contrary. I, this again is mythology. I mean, the author.
Would the Christianity, with all the saints, be a form of the same?
It's a compromise. Christianity has pagan elements. There's no question about it. Well, they tell you that this bread and this wine really is what do they call it? Transmutation or transfiguration? That this in itself is the body and the blood of Osa Ish. This is the pagan absurdity, the pagan trick of saying that God manifests himself in this thing. This is God during this moment that you worship, and later on it becomes transubstantiation, they call it.
Isn't that very similar to Buddha? I'm just reading it now as it comes to mind, where you can sort of, in a relation with something else, you sort of infuse the element of the divine in your relation with something else. It becomes... I don't understand it well. It sort of becomes exclusive, it becomes all enveloping. And your relation with this is something different other than when you objectify. In other words, afterwards it would become an object.
Well, I know what he means. He means when you have a dialogic relationship, the I-thou,
yeah.
So you raise it to a higher level. The trouble is this can develop into animism too. If you take Buber too seriously. In other words, I have this table, and no one is around here, it's all dark, mysterious, and I have an I-thou relationship to the table. It means I assume that the table is an active living being. Well, that's how the very, very primitive Indian, let's say, or Eskimo, worshipped. He thought that there are spirits that infuse the tables and the chairs, and he cowered in fear for them. Well, that's taking the I-thou relationship to an extreme. By I-thou, he means the accepting the opposite, someone else as an equal personality. If you use the I-thou relationship with relation to man and God, that's one thing. But you can overdo it too. The Indian, let's say, or the Canaanite, or the Buddhist, will use it with relation to a statue. That is Avodah Zarah. And when Avram lived, he lived in this kind of environment. This was the Avodah Zarah was not completely stupid. It was abhorrent, but it wasn't stupid. You see. That's why the Torah never uses the term ignorant. Or laughing at it.
That's
David HaMelech, it's much later. And what don't they know is an ethical point. He's not talking about Avodah Zarah. Before Rosh Hashanah Kumawaisa, he's talking about. It's talking about the Resha, about evil, about violence, corruption. See? The Torah does use the word Teweva, which means simply disgusting. Now what did Avraham do? So he says, V'acha she'orcho hayomim, after the days lengthened, in other words, after time passed, amdu b'vnei adam nevi'ei sheker, they had false prophets who said that the God said that Akum Ploni, or Kochovim, Hakrivo, Nesrolo, one second. Instead of the star itself, they substituted a symbol of the star, which means a statue of some kind. And he continues to describe, I don't want to read it to you, it's rather long. He continues to describe the various forms of Avodah Zarah. Afterwards, he says, now mind you, here he comes to the point. V'kivan she'archo hayomim, after time passed, and the first step was to believe in God. The second step was to believe that you have to honor that which God honored. Third, you build temples to it and sacrifice to it. Fourth, you make a representation of the stars or of the intermediary forces and you worship the statue, the representation. The next step, the fifth step, kivan she'archo hayomim, you forget that there was a God behind these and you worship only the representation, thinking that that is a God. You see? So this would be the lowest step of idolatry. The kind that I told you about would be the fourth step, rather than the fifth step. Until, Al-Derech Zeh Hayolam Holech U'Mizgalgel, this is the way the world went and developed or degenerated, Ad Shenolad Amuda Shel Olam V'Avram Avinu, until Abraham was born. Kivan Shenigmal Esan Zeh, when this powerful man was, notice the word he uses, Esan. I told you before, Esan Ha'ezrachi. When this great hero, when this powerful man was weaned, Hitzchil Leshotet Bedato, he began to wander in his mind. In other words, he wasn't satisfied with this stuff that he had been taught. V'hu Katan, he was young, V'hitzchil Lachshav B'yom V'alayla, began to ponder about the day and the night. V'hayat Tameya, he was wondering, Heich Efsha Shiyah HaGalgal Hazeh Noeg Tamid, how is it possible that this planet keeps on going in one line, v'lo yielom manhig, without anyone to guide it, umiyasabevoso, no one to turn it around. Which of God is he referring to? The second one. How is it possible for a world to go without a leader? It's impossible that the world should turn itself around, or that the picture should paint itself. V'lo hayolom malamed, v'lo modiyah davar. He had no teacher, no one to inform him. Elamushga bu'ur kasdim, he was sunk in Ur of the Ur of the Chaldees, the city Ur of the Kazdim. Bein Ovde Avodis Gachavim HaTipshim, he already calls them fools, between these foolish idol worshippers, because they were the fifth step. They actually worshipped the thing. The Ovid V'imo V'chola Om Ovde Akum, his whole family worshipped idols. He with them, who of it he also worshipped with them. V'libo Meshote, but his heart was wandering. Umeven, and trying to understand until he understood Al Derech HaEmes, V'heving kav hatzedek mitfunaso hanachona, he grasped truth and understood justice. In other words, Rambam is adding one point here. That Abraham's approach to God was not only through reason of logic of metaphysics, it was also through ethics. He began to understand the principle of justice, and there must be someone who declares what is just and what is unjust. V'yoda shi'esha maloa echad, he understood there must be one God who leads, who guides the stars. You see, he jumped backwards. He went backwards in these steps. He understood this statue must represent something, but that something must be created, and therefore why go around? He goes directly to God. There is no other God or representation of God other than God himself. He realized that the whole world is out of step with him. He is right and the whole world is wrong. He understood that what led them to this grievous error was she'ovdu mesekachovim vesatsuros at she'ovad emes midatam, that they began to worship intermediaries until they forgot what they began with. Uben aborim shana, he was 40 years old. He began when he was very young to wonder. He sort of combines both versions, whether he was 3 or 5 years old, or on the other hand, 40. He began at a very young age to ponder, and at 40 he came to the understanding of God. Kivon Shehiker, when he understood, acknowledged God, the Yoda, Hischil Hoshev Chuvas Bnei Yor Kasdim, he began to debate with people, to argue with them, to tell them what they are doing is wrong, to break the idols, to destroy them. and to tell all of them that there is only one God in the world who is worthy of being worshipped but no one else, that it is worth breaking all these other things. And Kiva Shagavalam, when he began to win over them and to convert them to the truth, they desired to kill them, and a miracle occurred. The miracle of the, well, you know the famous story of the miracle that threw him in the furnace and he escaped and he went to Haran. There he began to announce in a very loud voice to the whole world to tell them that there is one God in the world. And so he went, Vayikra B'Shem Hashem Kel Olam, and as people came around him, he began to convert them, and so on and so forth. He even writes that he began to write books, to publish his works, to publish his ideas. Abraham? Hard to say.
Was it
me? Very probably was.
Was?
Sure.
Who spoke Hebrew?
Abraham.
Did the people ask him Hebrew?
Of course. If you know Ugaritic, it is extremely close. Moabite is almost Hebrew itself. It's almost Hebrew. We have scripts of Moabite today that the Moabim spoke. Very similar to Hebrew. You don't know sometimes if it's a corrupt Hebrew or not. It's like Yiddish and German. We know German is a corrupt Yiddish. In the same way that Moabite is a cognate language. Probably Hebrew was existing then too. As if whether it existed at the beginning of creation, the Chazal have an agada that Adam did not know Hebrew. Adam spoke Aramaic, which means Aramaic is an older language, which is, you have it in the Torah too. Lavan spoke Aramaic. Yigarasa Hadusa, remember? Yigarasa Hadusa. So this is the understanding of idolatry that the Rambam gives us, and the kind of environment, the kind of very plausible environment in which Avram first began to flourish and he began to live. Now, as we pointed out at the very beginning, Vayomer Hashem al Avram, God says to Avram, Lech lecha me'artzecha u'me'moladetcha u'me'beis avicha el ha'oretz asher arecha. Go or get thee out of thy country, thy birthplace, father's house, into the land I will show you. Eldad points out that, as I told you, this is parallel to the beginning of the natural world, the beginning of Bereishis. Both the beginning of the world and the beginning of the Jewish people both begin with one thing. What is that? A command. Yehi Or drives away the physical blackness, and Lech Lecha begins to roll away the historic darkness, and a being begins to emerge into light, Avram. So it's interesting. The nature of mitzvah, this actually was a mitzvah. The whole description of the moral universe for the Jew is not a matter of reasoning primarily. It's not a matter of grace. Or just revelation, experience. It's almost always interpreted in forms of mitzvah, in forms of a commandment. The Or HaChaim, one of the very profound commentators on Chumash, asks a very interesting question. Look at verse 7. No, look at verse 1. What happens in verse 1? God says something to Abraham, yes? Did God say anything to Abraham before this that we know of? No. This speech continues until the end of verse 3, yes? Then Abraham goes, as God spoke to him. 5, Abraham does something. He takes people with him. 6, Abraham continues the action. Verse 7, what happens? Vayera Hashem al Avram. God appears to Abraham. What is the question that the Or HaChaim asks? You tell me. Isn't the order reversed? Shouldn't God first appear and then tell him something? No, God tells him something, then he appears to him. Isn't that strange? What happened with Moses? What came first? The revelation or the commandment?
The revelation.
Why, which one?
The burning bush.
First he sees a burning bush and his curiosity is piqued. He comes close and suddenly he hears a voice. With Abraham it's reversed. First there is a command. Then there is an appearance of God, a revelation. What's going on here? So the Or HaChaim gives two answers, both of which are important. The first one, he says that Abraham already knew God rationally. He had already arrived, according to the Agada, which is in this case we accept as normative, that Abraham had already come to the understanding of the Ribbono Shel Olam. He knew God, so that there was no need for God to appear to him for appearance's sake. And all God had to do was to tell him, do this or do that. There was no need, in other words, for him to identify himself. There was a need only to give a specific message. The identification could wait until later. The second reason, the second answer the Aruch Hayim gives, is that for 10 generations, there had been no one who knew God. Asara daros menoach ad Avraham. During these 10 generations, the knowledge of God had lapsed from the world. Except for the family of Shem, according to one Agada, which one school continued throughout, the school of Shem. But insofar as even then, there are Agadas that there was nothing else. The story of Shem is a queer one. It's hard to trace. One of them is that Shem continued the knowledge of God. The preponderant thing is that it had disappeared by then. Abraham
said it.
No, Malkit is different. We'll come to him later on. Malkit said, I believe in the chief of a pantheon.
How's that?
Sure. El Elyon, the highest God. There are a lot of gods, and there's one God that's over above all the others. El Elyon.
Wow.
Incidentally, the term El Elyon, I'm not saying Kael Elyon. El Elyon, the chief God. Isn't that what it means? El Elyon is the chief God. There are a lot of gods. This was the chief God. He said, your God, Abraham, I accept him as my chief God. Precisely. Yes.
In other words, the expression would be similar. You shall have no other gods before
me. Yeah. That's El Elyon. Do not accept me as chief of a pantheon. I'm the only God.
What we say, El Elyon,
yes, we change terms. Abraham answers Melchizedek, El Elyon is Kone Shemayim Varas, there are no other gods. It's not only an El Elyon. You see, this is the nature of the debate. We'll come to that later on, it's rather important. So that for 10 generations, there was no knowledge of God. Let's assume that the yeshiva of Shem Ve'eva was reconstituted by Abraham, but there was no knowledge. So the answer here would be, according to the Aruch Hayim, why did the revelation come after the commandment? Because God wanted to see first whether Abraham will listen. If he'll listen, then he'll give him his revelation. Now, what is the difference between these two answers as to the nature of revelation itself? According to the first answer, revelation is for what purpose? For the purpose of identification. Who is it who speaks? You've got to make a person aware of God before this God can tell him to do something. He has to know who the mitzvah is before he reacts to the mitzvah. Who is the commander before he accepts the commandment? So that revelation is primarily for purposes of identification, nothing more. Nothing so great about it. The second answer shows us that revelation is in the form of what? Of reward. Revelation is a special experience, a unique experience that God vouchsafes only for those who are deserving of it. That otherwise revelation doesn't occur to a person. So that this is more of a modern view, whereas the first one I think is more Jewish. That revelation as such is an overwhelming experience, but in itself it's not important. What is important is the message of revelation. The first answer would have it that the message is very important, but revelation is important too, in the sense that if you deserve, you will have a vision of God, no matter what you are told in that vision.
The experience, though, isn't so important.
No, according to the first answer, not. According to the second, yes. The experience is very important, and therefore you have to be deserving of it. But not that you can divorce it from the message. And this has to remain the Jewish scheme, because after all, Vayomer comes before Vayera. But certainly they're connected with each other. As a matter of fact, in the next Sedra of Vayera, you know, the next Sedra begins on what page? Page 24. And the Lord appeared to him in the grove of Mamre while he was sitting at the door of the tent in the heat of the day, and something occurred. And the immediate question that the rabbis ask is, God appeared. What did he say? What happened? What do you mean God appeared to him? See, for a Christian, the question doesn't hold any water. God appeared to him. He had a vision. He fell down. He fainted. He felt an ilui neshama. Wonderful. That's sufficient. The Jewish commentators, the Mefarshim, They didn't understand. What do you mean God appeared to him? Well, if he appeared to him, what did he say to him? He didn't say anything to him. So they have to devise answers. That Rambam says the whole story that follows was the appearance of, was a vision. The three angels that came to him didn't occur while he was awake. They occurred in the vision of God. And that was the vision. Because that contained the besura, contained the mitzvah of Mila, and so on and so forth. So that the presupposition of the Jew is that the revelation has to be connected with my life, with telling me something that may be of value to other people too. It isn't only a private little experience that I undergo and that gives me a thrill like coming down the roller coaster. This is a roller coaster and this is seeing God. By nature, you're putting them on the same level. The Jew never understood this. To the Jew, it was something that's completely different for the purpose of affecting life. What about Nasa Vishma? Yes. Yes. The idea being, you know, there's a book coming out now by the Nazir in Yerushalayim, by Rabbi Cohen. Have you heard of the Nazir in Yerushalayim? You ever in Jerusalem?
You visited it now, I understand.
Yes, how do you know? Yes.
I heard you mention it.
Yes, I mentioned before I was going to see him. He is the only one in the Western world who is a Nazir. You know, a man has long hair, white hair down to here, long beard. A Talmud of Rabbi Cook. He is publishing a book that's coming out very shortly in which he tries to, well, it's, what shall I call it, an acoustic philosophy. He tries to show that Judaism bases much more on hearing than on sight. On hearing than on sight. The idea of seeing is played down. The idea of hearing is played up. Can you see God? No. Can you hear him? Certainly. Matan Torah emphasizes that you heard God, but you never saw anything.
What, but you saw thundering.
But you didn't see God. Yes, but it's played down. So what does Chazal say? So what does the Abba say immediately afterwards? Ra'u es hanishma. They saw that which is normally heard. Again, to try to play down the seeing and pick up the hearing. The reason for it is very simple. Again, to minimize representation. And to build up shmiya generally means intellectual knowledge. When Sa'adja, let's say, in the Middle Ages, is looking for a good Hebrew term, Hebrew-Arabic term, to show you the idea of obedience to God for obedience sake, as opposed to purely rational knowledge, but obedience to the Rabbeinu Shalom, what does he call these mitzvahs? Shimios, from the word Shema, to hear, obedience. So in the same way, Na'aseh v'nishma applies that the revelation is not merely seeing a vision, but primarily to hear in order to do. So the hearing leads immediately to an action because you have a message. When you see, there's no message involved. It's just an experience. When you hear, there's already a message addressed to you. So this is one of the main points of the book that's forthcoming. I haven't seen the book yet, but this I understand is the one of his major themes. Now, before I go any further, just to make one interesting point that Kasuto points out very interestingly. In the beginning, the first, if you separate between verse 1 and verse 7, verse 1 begins Vayomer Hashem, and the second one is verse 7 is Vayera Hashem. In other words, and this is almost the reverse of what I just said, he says as follows, why in the first part God, Abraham only hears something? He hears a command. In the second one he has a vision, a revelation of God. Why? He doesn't ask the question of why the difference in order. That's the Or HaChaim. Kasuto asks, what is the difference? Why didn't he say in the beginning Vayera and later on as well? He says in the beginning he was a Chutz La'aretz. He was outside of Israel. Vayera, it's verse 7, he was already in Eretz Yisrael. And the level of prophecy was much higher. Kasuto did not realize when he wrote this, I don't know why, he's a scholar, he should have picked it up, that Rambam in the third part of the Mora Nevuchim, in discussing the various degrees of prophecy, points out that when the prophet sees something in his mind's eye, again, not seeing literally, that's why it's not the reverse, really the reverse of what I said. When he sees a vision and he hears a voice, the vision is higher than the voice. If someone only hears something without seeing anything, then it's a lower degree of prophecy than seeing and hearing. So it does fit in. He should have quoted the Rambam. But he didn't. He said it al da'as atzma. He said it as if it were his own invention. But this does fit in here, with, of course, Moses being an exception completely in a different category of prophecy. So therefore, when Abraham was outside of Israel, he had a lower degree of prophecy. When he came to Israel, it was a higher degree of prophecy. To this is something which Yehuda HaLevi very strongly affirms, that prophecy is unique to the land of Israel, and the only time you find prophecy outside the land of Israel is when it relates to the land of Israel. That's why Yechezkel was able to prophesy, even though he was in... Where was Yechezkel? In Babylonia. What city?
In Tel Aviv.
Of course, it wasn't our Tel Aviv. It was Tel Aviv, the ancient Tel Aviv in Babylon. He prophesied, so did Daniel. But their prophecies related to the Holy Land. Similarly, Abraham, the very first one, was a prophecy which, what? Related to where to go to. Where should he go to? To the Holy Land.
Wasn't Terah headed for
Canaan? Yes, he never reached there, though.
But why was he going towards Canaan at all?
Business.
So what was the special Abraham going on to Canaan? His father was going to Canaan?
But they stopped in Haran. Don't forget, this going was a matter of stopping there. And besides that, did God tell Abraham where he's sending him? You find very often with Abraham, he never knows where he's going. God tells him here, go to the land which I'll show you. Where else do you find this with Abraham? The Akedah. Go to one of the mountains which I will show you. He doesn't tell him which mountain. Again, it's God's confidence in Abraham's confidence in him. The perfect confidence in Avraham. That Avraham is faithful to the point of being willing to listen even though he hasn't got it clearly shown where he's heading for.
Well,
after
a vision like that, you would expect no questions,
true, except that Abraham is the model of Emuna. Umatzasa es levavo ne'eman lefanecha. Abraham's Emuna is exemplary. There's no one else who achieves this Emuna. And this is one of the points that proves it. When God talks to Moshe, he tells him exactly what he's going to tell him. And when Chazal compare Moshe and Avraham, Moshe reached a higher degree of Nevuah. But Avraham remains supreme in the realm of Emunah. Avraham's Emunah is regarded as greater than that of Moshe. It's true that after an experience of this sort, he shouldn't have to be told. But don't forget that it was a completely novel experience to him. He had no tradition of there being a God. Moshe already knew there was a God. So when he had the vision, he was able to identify him. Abraham knew of a God only as a result of an intellectual abstraction. But this first vision, he could very well have said, maybe I'm being deluded. Maybe in my old age, or he was young there. Maybe in my young age, he says, perhaps this is a young man's fantasy.
Not like that.
I mean, very well could have been a delusion. I mean, a man sees visions and hears sounds, he might have thought, well, look, it's hallucinations. How do I know that it's real? This is the question that occurs to every prophet. And the point is that it becomes so overwhelming that he knows that it's true. After a while, he doesn't doubt that this vision here. You know where you find it? With Shmuel. When Samuel first hears a voice in the night, Shmuel!
Well, he thinks it's alien. He doesn't think it's an illusion.
Yeah, but maybe it's an illusion, but he doesn't know what it is. He doesn't know that it's God.
No, well, that's the whole thing. Voice.
Yeah, the whole thing. Now, this voice says, Shmuel, go jump in the ocean. Would he have done it? No, he doesn't know who's talking to him. Now, the same way, Avram hears a voice, it's God. Who's God? He never heard of God before. Could this be the God that I thought of? Well, maybe I'm trying to convince myself psychologically what I thought of logically. So the point is, he did not involve himself in these skepticisms. That is the element of Emunah, the leap.
It appears that Abraham appears on a scene completely full-blown spiritually.
Yeah, completely. Yeah.
Moses grows.
Very true. Very, very true. Very true. Moses goes slowly. He achieves chesed and this and that. We don't even know from the story of Moshe what he knows and what he doesn't know about the Ribono Shel Olam. It seems that he only has a distant knowledge, a traditional knowledge, not a personal knowledge. And that's why he was so overwhelmed by the burning bush and everything else. Of course, he grows very quickly once he reaches that stage. He grows ethically slowly, with the stories of the daughters of Midian and the story of the protecting the underdog. He comes through religion, not through reasoning, as ever, interestingly, isn't it? It just occurs to me. According to the Agada, how does Avraham come to religion? Through reason. And Moshe? Through Masa, through ethics, through justice. Each one has a different approach. They arrive at the very same conclusion, but they come to it differently. It shows you the two ways of coming there. It may be why Lutzato, Shmuel David Lutzato, in his philosophy, speaks about the two different revelations. Avraham being primarily addressed to the whole man, man who can achieve godliness without law, or without too much law, and Moshe appearing to an age which is already sunk, and where only law can help. Avraham can convince with reason, and Moshe must convince with action. He must strike the Egyptian and give laws. And that whereas Abraham's attitude and approach was sufficient for his age, Moshe's approach had to be taken from then on for all eternity. Okay.
This is the, with modifications or without, the way you wanted, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth.
Yes, of course. Of course. It means the element of capital punishment, which is done for one who deserves capital punishment. So your question is, why do we have it? It's a long shmuas. Really, it's a long talk. I think there are many elements to capital punishment that have to be understood. I'm afraid that if I should go into this discussion now and try to explain it fully, I will risk that same kind of punishment by this class. So that, since I want to minimize capital punishment, I'd like to take this the opportunity to discuss it at the very next session, whenever it will be. Because there are various elements involved. You look in the Torah, why do you have capital punishment? The Torah gives you more than one reason. And there are certain very interesting Talmudic passages with regard to a very modern, almost an avant-garde attitude towards capital punishment without the soft liberal sentimentalism, but a very clear-headed, advanced, modern notion that the Talmud, that the Sanhedrin put into effect as many as... I'll tell you in a minute how many years ago. 40 years before the Churban means how many years? The year 30, 1931 years ago. We know the exact date when they took action based on a certain very logical and modern and enlightened, let me call it, philosophy of capital punishment, penological attitude. But I'd like to, if you don't mind, I'm not trying to avoid the question, I just don't want to get involved in something I will not be able to explain adequately. And so I hope will you all do me the favor, please, of signing. I want to keep a record of those who are here.